106.3 FM. Stadsradio Delft. U luistert naar een uitzending van de Delftse gezamenlijke kerken op Stadsradio Delft.
Welkom terug voor het tweede half uur van het programma Kerk in Delft van Voordoor en met de Kerken. Jan, wat zit er in dit half uur?
Nou, we maken het ons zelf een beetje makkelijk het tweede half uur. Want je hebt een tijd geleden een prachtig interview opgenomen met John Rutter.
Ja.
Een Engels componist, meen ik. Die vooral bekend is om zijn religieuze composities.
Ja, koormuziek. Ik denk dat je rond de kerst zeker geen kerk in kunt lopen. Of een koor zingt wel een werk van Rutter.
Een autoriteit die, ik zie nou even wanneer die geboren is, die op zijn 12e al een kerstlied heeft gecomponeerd.
Ja, dat mag je zeggen. Hij vindt zelf heel verbazingwekkend. Hij heeft dat inderdaad 50 jaar geleden gecomponeerd. En hij zegt, het is nog steeds een van de meest populaire carols die er gedraaid wordt en gezongen wordt.
Ja, dat valt in de categorie wonderkinderen zoals Mozart en Schubert en
in feite hè? Wel. Zo ziet hij het zelf overigens niet, maar ik denk dat we het wel zo mogen beschouwen.
Ja, ik denk dat we het wel zo mogen beschouwen. Hè? Ja.
En het is een ontzettend aimabele man, kan ik je zeggen. Het is een plezier om hem te interviewen, want hij weet veel, hij vertelt graag. Overigens is het interview in het Engels. Dus ik hoop dat onze luisteraars daar geen problemen mee hebben. Laten we maar gewoon gaan luisteren. Het is opgenomen in het huis van Petra Weijers aan het Begijnhof. En ik heb daar uiterst genoegelijk met hem zitten spreken. Goedemiddag en hartelijk welkom. Ik zal u vertellen dat ik een beetje zit te shaken hier. Want tegenover mij zit een van mijn grote idolen als het gaat om hedendaagse kerkmuziek. Mr. John Rutter. En daarom zal het interview ook in het Engels gaan plaatsvinden. Dus zo, Mr. Rutter, I'll switch to English for you. How does it feel to have one of your most performed works, I would guess, with a project choir? How does that feel for you?
Oh, I've done it many times before with project choirs. But the chemistry of every performance is different. You can't, even with the same people, predict exactly how a piece of music is going to sound. It may be that you do two or three performances and they will all be different. And of course, the language that a choir speaks naturally will change the colour of the musical tone. And that's a fascinating thing for me because I work with choirs all over the world and they all have a different way of speech, and that makes the music change, even when they're singing the same notes with the same Latin text. I mean, Latin is a very useful language because choir people all over the world pretty much know Latin.
Exactly.
So I've been very impressed with the English, of course, singing I've heard. There are bits of the text that are in English, and it's immaculate. They sing better English than I do, so I'm very
that's
pleased.
That's a big compliment for the choir, then. Well, we do have a lot of English classes in school, of course, so that helps. I personally love this CD. I've owned it for a few years, and I also love the fact that you've included a Claire Benediction, which was dedicated to your alma mater, which is one of my favorite pieces. I also love the fact that you sang Cantique de Jean Racine by Fauré, which is also quite a popular piece here in the Netherlands. We have top 300 of classical works that from next week will be played on the national radio. They called it the Heart and Soul list. And actually this piece comes in at, I think, position 4 this year.
Oh my.
So it's a really, really popular piece for choirs, also in churches. Mm. As I said, you are one of the most well-known composers of contemporary religious music. I think I could say that about you. So what made you decide to write specifically religious music?
Well, I don't, because I write all sorts of music. My obligation when I set a text is towards that text, whether it's secular and it's a text by Shakespeare, or whether it's a religious text that comes from the Bible or the Psalms or whatever. The composer's job, I think, is to serve the text and to enter into that text and to try and understand it and to carry the message of the text into the hearts of the listener. And that's the wonderful thing about melody. The melody is a great carrier of words. And if you want people to really take words to their heart, often it's better to sing them than to speak them. And so, of course, I have written a lot of sacred music over the years. A lot of the reason for that is just that I've got asked to. That many of the opportunities that I was given, particularly in my early years, came from church choirs, cathedral choirs, college choirs, and so on. And in a way, one sacred piece can lead to another, because if you set one psalm text, then somebody else will ask you to set another psalm text. And that's fine, because there is so much vision and inspiration to be had from religious texts of every kind. And the ones I tend to know best are the Christian ones, because I was baptized into the Church of England. I grew up singing not just in my school chapel choir, but in my parish church choir as well. And so I was very well versed in the music and the liturgy and the traditions of the church from an early age, and that has stayed with me.
I can imagine. So you don't really expect it to be a religious composer, but I can imagine if you are a secular composer, the message can be hard to put to music. So would you say that being religious helps you to put the message into the music?
I think you have to have a sense of faith. By that, I mean that you have to understand what faith feels like.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't do that, then it's better to stay away, probably, from setting religious texts. But then one of the jobs of an artist is to enter into other states mm-hmm. of being. And if you think of William Shakespeare, our greatest dramatist, think of a play like Othello, which is a very dark play about jealousy. And I don't suppose Shakespeare really ever felt so jealous of his wife that he wanted to murder her.
I hope not.
I hope not too. But the thing was, he knew exactly what that felt like, because Othello is just driven to the point of madness to commit murder. And you believe it, you know, when it's happening on the stage. And that's one of the things I enjoy about composition, that composer colleague of mine, Richard Rodney Bennett, put it rather well when he said it's almost like you're walking around the moon when you're writing a piece of music, that you're stumbling round on a lunar landscape all by yourself with rocks and an eerie kind of light, and you have no companions. And you want to return to Earth. But until your work is completed, your mission is accomplished, you have to stay there. And I think my family would probably tell you that I'm a bit like that. And it is quite normal for composers that I feel when I'm writing that I'm sort of in a world that's somewhere else. And it's a little bit like, I suppose swimmers must feel, if you dive underwater, you know, you're underwater,
and the
you
color is different.
Everything is different. Will I ever come back to the surface again? And of course you do. And composers generally feel happiest when they've just finished a piece. And I think that's probably when I feel happiest. You know, for about 10 minutes, I think, that's done. That's all written. And then generally the urge or the itch, call it what you like, it starts up again a little bit later. And it usually happens that there's a piece I promised I will write, so anyway, there's a deadline to meet, and I start composing all over again. But the fun thing about conducting is it's the best excuse I have not to be composing, because when you're conducting, you can't also compose at the same time.
True.
And I enjoy conducting all music, really, not just my own. I most often get asked to conduct things I've written, but in a way, there's more challenge in conducting something that someone else has written, because unless the composer is alive and standing right there, I can't ask them, well, what did you mean right there? But of course, if I've written it, I generally know what I meant. And so conducting is, for me, relaxation and therapy. And above all, it's social, which, of course, composition isn't. You know?
No, that's really a solitary piece of work that you're doing and conducting. You have this relationship with the choir, basically. And with the musicians, of course, if they are there.
Sure.
Well, it's really funny because 2 weeks ago I was talking to David Hurley, who was a former member of the King's Singers.
Yes.
And he rehearsed a piece called The Goslings that they have also performed.
Oh, yes.
And it's such a silly little piece of music.
Yes.
But it was really cleverly put together with the wedding march that goes in and then comes back again, and then it drops into the minor key. And he said the risk with this piece is you make a sketch out of it.
Mm.
So you make it into a little performance.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, no, let the melody and the music and the text surprise people.
Mm.
Don't give it away by your facial expressions. And as soon as the choir realized what he was saying, it was like, ah. And then they started singing again. And suddenly there was this excitement. It was like, huh, now we know what he's talking about. And it was really funny. I was sitting there in the audience and even I felt it. Because he was explaining it in such a way that even if they didn't really understand the English, sometimes that might be a barrier. But even so, that they understood what he wanted them to feel, and it came through. And that for me was quite amazing. And I think that's what you're trying to do as well.
Well, as a conductor, you've got to convey that vision that's inside your head. In the old days of tape recorders, what I would have said is that every conductor has a tape playing in his or her head of the perfect performance, and only you can hear it. But you somehow have got to explain to the real-life human performers in front of you what it is that you're hearing, and you have to somehow help them to do it in exactly the way that you think the composer would have wanted it to be done. And that's one of the challenges. Sometimes it's best done not with words, actually, but just with gesture or with telepathy. You know, the way that conductors communicate is something that you could write books about. And it's a mystery, really. Nobody has got to the bottom of it, because some conductors talk a lot. Some talk very little. Some are very exuberant with their gestures, and Leonard Bernstein was like that. And then some are very economical, like Pierre Boulez, who moved about very little. But they both got, Bernstein and Boulez, two great conductors
Absolutely.
I was privileged to have watched on more than one occasion. They both got fabulous results. And so there's no right or wrong way of doing it. But it's all to do with the alchemy of turning the base metal of a first rehearsal into the pure gold of a performance. And that's what we're all striving to achieve.
So you're hoping for a bit of alchemical gold tomorrow?
Yes!
Well, considering what I've just heard, I think you're well on your way. And yes, I absolutely feel that the chemistry was there.
I've had a lot of practice.
Yes, of course.
And
but still,
of course, the thing is knowing when to rehearse, and sometimes knowing when to stop rehearsing, because it's a good thing. It took me years to learn trust in human relationships, and in musical relationships is a good thing. And if you do show trust, then it's often repaid. And of course, if there's a work with many technical obstacles that have to be overcome patiently, then you may well need every moment of rehearsal that you've got, or be wishing for more of it. But then sometimes, as with my Requiem, it's not really a very difficult work technically. What's difficult about it is to just get the sense of the words and the music and how it all plays out.
The timing.
And yes. And that's not a technical thing mainly. It's more almost a spiritual thing,
the sensitivity
really.
Towards and, the message.
It, sometimes it's better to just let people sleep on the rehearsal they've done and just reflect. And that's what we're doing right now.
But I think the part, you are, of course, a bit of a celebrity. So I feel that people want to perform well because you are there in front of them. Do you feel that that puts pressure on them?
I hope not. It does mean that it's a bonus when you come in with some sort of a reputation. I always feel sorry for young conductors who nobody's heard of. And they're coming in for the first time, and none of the performers, whether they're professional or amateur, knows anything about them. And you have to prove yourself that you must show that you know more about the music than they do and that you have some vision of it. When you have been going as long as I have, generally word gets around. And I've heard it said about certain conductors, oh, he's very difficult, or he's very demanding, or somebody else might be said, oh, he's just easy to work with, you don't have to worry. And so I think, as a matter of fact, it's beneficial on both sides if you have been going for some length of time. In my case, I've been conducting ever since I was a student, and that was a long time ago now. And people gradually get to hear about you. They hear recordings. They sometimes see concerts, which, of course, these days you can sometimes just watch on YouTube. You know, you might not even have to be there in the concert hall. And that gives people a sense of who they're going to be working for and what they're aiming at. Mm-hmm. And so that's, I wouldn't say it's pressure on the performers. I actually think it's an incentive. And I don't believe in conductors being grand and just saying, do it this way because I say so. You don't automatically get respect in any walk of life these days. I mean, there was, when I was a kid, automatic respect for doctors, teachers,
police officers,
and you don't get that now. And people do still respect other people, but only usually because that person has earned their respect. And maybe that's good. Maybe that's a good thing. So conductors, I don't know whether they used to get automatic respect. They don't now. You have to earn it, and that's fine. And of course, the pressure that it puts on you as a conductor is that you're only as good as your last concert. You know,
that's true.
You have to keep proving that if you ever were good, that you're still good. So I don't worry about that too much. I just do my best. The nice thing about a concert is that it's a bit like being an airline pilot. As conductor, you're steering people through that concert, through that flight. And once you've landed at the end, there's nothing more you can do. It's over. You've flown the flight. You hope you didn't give people a bumpy ride, and you hope they landed safely. And so there's nothing you can worry about until you have to do the next one. And trouble with being a composer is you're always worrying. That I remember the great William Walton, one of the most marvellous of 20th century composers and a great inspiration to me. He was never happy with anything he'd written, and he kept going back and changing things. I remember with the violin concerto, there were, I think, 5 different versions. He kept tinkering with it and going back to it and saying, nah, that's not quite right. And in the end, I think he went back to the first version he'd done because he said, oh, I should have left it alone. But he never stopped worrying. And that's one of the things that composers have to live with, that the perfect composition doesn't exist. And we do our best and we make mistakes, and sometimes we hit the target and sometimes we miss. And sometimes we write a good piece that somehow people don't seem to take to. But then again, sometimes we write pieces afterwards where we think, oh, that was an awful piece, but everybody seems to like it. And I'm not going to tell you which pieces I wrote that are like that. There are a few.
Well, I'm going to ask my final question because I don't want to keep you that much longer. You've had a busy day already. If you could choose one existing piece of music that you would have composed, you wanted to compose, what would that be?
Oh, that's impossible to say, because if I say to you Mozart's Figaro or Bach's Matthew Passion, they're kind of ideals of perfection that stemmed from the pen of composers who were geniuses. So there's no point in envying genius. Genius lies beyond gender, it lies beyond time, it lies beyond social status, it lies beyond fashion. It is somewhere up there on its cloud, and it's there to inspire us. Because if we didn't have genius to inspire us, we would be like bread that has no yeast, that never rises. So what I'm going to say is I would love to have written one of the most successful of Rossini's operas, and I don't mind which one, because, excuse me, opera lovers, if you think Rossini was the greatest genius who ever lived, I don't think he was a genius. I think he was a very clever, witty composer who knew what he could do and who stretched what he could do. And in some of the operas, he took just almost nothing and spun it out to over 2 hours of music with skill and wit and to the delight of an audience. And he didn't care what anybody thought about it in 50 years' time. He said, I just have to have this ready for the premiere next month. And I know who I'm writing for.
Nou, helaas hebben we het laatste restje van Rutter niet kunnen horen. Ik wenste hem een heel goed concert. Want hij zou op dat moment een concert gaan geven met zijn requiem. Met het projectkoor in de kerk aan het Begijnhof. En dat was wat ik in ieder geval van de mensen gehoord heb, een enorm succes. Dus alle zangers hebben het ook met heel veel plezier gedaan.
Okay, leuk, maar goed. Ja, de installatie had even zijn eigen zin. Nou,
ja, dat gebeurt wel eens. Techniek.
De bokkenprijk op. Het is bijna oud, ja.
Dan krijg je dat soort dingen, hè.
Luisteraars, we gaan afscheid van u nemen.
Behalve vrede en alle goed wensen u natuurlijk sowieso dat ook voor het nieuwe jaar. Want dat is al bijna. Nog één dagje.
Eet niet te veel oliebollen en appelflappen.
Doe voorzichtig met vuurwerk.
Let op de drank. Zonder al te moraliserend willen zijn. En wij nemen afscheid van u met onze vaste groet.
Vrede en alle goed.
Tot volgend jaar, luisteraars.